My God, that's what I wrote. I want to begin with a little bit of operationalism on sort of non-quantum mechanical models, but to illustrate some of the things that Alex talked about with actual implementation of a very simple experiment showing how the testable events are built and how they are accumulated together in a very intuitive way, as any reasonable first, second, or third grader could probably do without much mathematics, and that this grouping together forms what we think of as a quantum logic, or what we call a quantum logic, even if there's no quantum mechanics in it. But it gives a good paradigm on which to build a latter part of the talk. And this is all rather straightforward. And so I'll begin here. So I have this is such a interesting little experiment that every time I give a talk, no matter what the talk is about, I always begin with this. It's probably the only thing I really understand deeply at this point. But we have a simple little experiment with two observers. And there's a box with transparent walls, as we saw the other day. And it's a simpler box. It doesn't have three windows. It only has two. We have two observers, E and F. And there's a firefly, as illustrated, flying around in the box, blinking his light. And the observer E, if the light is on, records up or down. Or if the light is off, he records no light. The observer F, if the light is on, records left or right, or she records no light if the light is off. We'll make one stipulation that if they were to both look at the same time and the light were off, they would both record no. And that I have carefully phrased that sentence in the subjunctive because there's no way to test it. And the idea is that these two partners do not communicate, and that is the meaning of the diagonal line. So we have a set of outcomes which are up, down, left, right, and no light. And I have illustrated that picture in what I call the orthogonality diagram in the lower right. E is the three-element set. U, D, N, and F is the three-element set, N, R, L. And that is called the outcome orthogonality diagram. The lines meaning in that diagram mean that if you were to obtain the outcome up, you could not obtain the outcome down or no. It's an operational rejection idea. Okay. So it's a very simple experiment. And it illustrates the ideas that have been presented in the last few days, I think, very nicely. And so now I want to talk about what I would call testable events. These are the events that you can see through these tests. And I have arranged them in this array for a reason. And so if we look at the operation E, then what we see is in the operation E was up, down, and no light. And then there is the empty event below them. Notice above up, down, and no light, there are pairs of elements. For example, above up is down no. Notice that it is the complement in the set E of up. Now if we go to the next one, it's an observation in the down position, then complement in E would be up, no. It's recorded above. So each outcome, U, D, N, L, R, has right above it a two-point set, which is its relative complement in that respective operation. Notice that over no light, there are two pairs. The opposite of no light is that the light is on. And by the convention that if the light is off, that they both record off, then they should both record on if the light is on. Notice that the opposite of no light, if observed from each position, is either left, right, or up, down. So that those two events represent the same physical idea and thus should be lumped together in a sort of intuitive way. And of course, then we have each of the full events, E and F, meaning that we simply looked. And we have the empty event means that we didn't look, or some such interpretation. So we have all of these events, and I have circled them together with red, trying to indicate how they occur in an equivalent way. Now, that equivalent way is therefore recorded down on the lower right in what we call an operational logic, or more commonly today, a quantum logic. Each little node represents one of these equivalence classes of events. So, for example, at the bottom we have the proposition associated with the empty event. And if you go across the next row above, it would begin P, a proposition associated with the outcome up, and so on. And since I can't record all of the words in that diagram, I've recorded a few. The middle one is the proposition of observation of no light. The node just above it is its complement, which is the proposition PLR, or equivalently P up, down. And of course, the two, E and F, are circled together and accumulated into the unit of this logic. So the logic in these operational situations is simply the equivalence classes put together in this fashion. Now, this particular example was first presented to me when I first began thinking about these things in a paper by Dave Follis and Charlie Randall, which they published in 1972, called Operational Statistics 1, which, what journal was it, Dave? Is it the Journal of Math Physics? Yeah, Journal of Math Physics. It was the first paper I read on this stuff, and when I first began thinking about these things. I was trained as a functional analyst in the 60s, and the last course I took in physics, I think, was 1959, and I read Electricity and Magnetism, I think, out of Slater and Frank or something like that. And so this is, I approach all of this with the previous the training that I had as an analyst. And so the talk I'm going to give you today, with this as paradigm, I'm going to begin with a logic, which is one of these orthomodular posets. And I'm going to look at something called states, which I'm going to show you a picture of for this example in just a moment. And I'm going to put these, the logic and the states, into paired, linear, normed, partially ordered spaces. And I'm going to look at them in Banach duality with one another. And I'm going to ask some simple questions about dual spaces and pre-duals. And then I'm going to interpret these questions in terms of the axioms of Ludwig and a paper by Gunson, which came out in the late 60s, and show that these function analytic assumptions and conditions frequently subsume some of the physical assumptions that they made in their papers. Well, you'll see what I mean in a moment. Okay, last picture associated with this example. We've talked about the outcomes, the operationalism, the events, the formed logic, and now I want to talk about probabilities or weights on this physical situation. By a weight, as Alex defined, is a mapping from the outcomes into the unit interval from 0 to 1. is a function such that when you apply it to each of the operations, E or F, and you add it up orthogonally, that is to say, over each point in each operation, it should add up to 1. They are the operational probabilities, if you will, on this outcome. And I would like to draw a picture of what all the possible probabilities look like for this experiment. If we looked from the left, that is to say, from E, we could see up, down, or no light. And the pure states would be, if we look and we see up, we get that with certainty with a 1, then down must be 0, and no light must be 0, because the light is on. Now notice, it doesn't tell us anything about what happens in the other experiment of looking upward. So there are two extremes for that situation. Either the other observer must see the light, they could see it either in the left position or in the right position. So the state which assigns the value 1 to the up position can assign 2 pure extensions, either left or right. There's not a unique extension to the whole experiment. And so I have listed those 4 pure states associated with seeing light on the left, seeing light on the upper position, seeing light on the down position. It's 2 extensions, and the corresponding 2 extensions for the others. And they are listed as the points around the bottom. So for example, in the left corner, when I look and I see omega LD, what I mean is that's the state that observes 1 for L and 1 for down, and correspondingly around the base. And the point on the top records a situation that no light is observed. And notice it's of a different character than the others because it's at the top of this tetrahedron. Notice also in this case that this convex compact set of states is not a simplex. It is not a simplex because the logic is not a Boolean algebra. It is 2 Boolean algebras pasted together along that PN, PN prime line. And in general, if you want to have the state space being a simplex, it will have to be that these operational logics, essentially modulo some extra hypotheses, must be Boolean algebras. Okay. So what I will do now with this idea is that I will simply lift this state space and this logic into function spaces in an obvious way. Let me just say it in words. Notice that the states are mappings on the set X. Each such mapping on the outcome space X can be lifted to the propositions by simply adding up. If I want to define omega of P of A, as it says on the bottom, I look at the event A that created P of A, and I add up the omegas on those elements, and that sum gives us a mapping on the logic. So the states or proposition, these operational states, when lifted up onto the logic, naturally live in the function space of pi into the real numbers, in particular into the interval from 0 to 1. Likewise, if the omegas act on pi as functions, the points in pi, the logic was the name I gave it, the name pi, pi acts on the states as functions, just as if we calculate f of x, we think of f acting on x, we can think of x acting on f. And so this is the duality of where the states and the logic act on one another and generate corresponding linear spaces. So in this case, this state space is 3-dimensional. and therefore the engulfing space which will hold it as the base for a cone must be four-dimensional, just as the space which holds the logic will be its dual space, which will also be four-dimensional. As I say, this is where we begin. I want to look at spaces of states on orthomodular posets as linear functionals acting on state spaces. So I need to write down a few facts about Banach spaces. And I did write them down, but time evolution got them. If you took a course in functional analysis, and one of the main things you did when you studied things like Banach spaces, there were lots of examples of Banach spaces, and there were all these theorems named after Riesz, in which you took the Banach space and you calculated a representation for its dual space. And one of the main projects in the first course in functional analysis is to, as you work the examples out, is to calculate what all the dual spaces look like. And what you find, of course, is that they go back into the list of spaces you've already started with. For example, if we take the space L1 of a sigma finite measure or a probability measure, then we discover that its dual space is L infinity over the same algebra. If we start with LP, then we construct its dual. It's LQ, where 1 over P plus 1 over Q is 1, and P and Q are greater than 1, and less than infinity, of course. The next example that we frequently deal with, P, of course, when P is 2, we have our friend Hilbert space. If we deal with the continuous functions on a compact Hausdorff space, which are real valued, or in fact complex valued, but for the moment just say real valued, what we discover as a dual is the space of Borel measures on X, R, and the norm that's given on that space of measures is the norm of sine measures, that is, it's the norm of total, what's called total variation. The simple examples of some of these is if I look at the space of sequences convergent to zero, given the soup norm of the coordinates, it has a dual, which is the absolutely summable sequences, with the absolute sum as the norm, which has a dual, which is the set of bounded sequences. And this has a dual, which generally we don't study, but it turns out that it is the set of all finitely additive measures on the integers, signed measures, of course, on the integers, having finite total variation. So it's analogous to what we have above. And one last sequence of operations. If I start off with Hilbert space, and I don't care if I deal with self-adjoints or the actual operator algebras, I don't care what's complex spaces, then if you construct the dual of the compact operators, then you end up with the trace class operators with the trace norm in analogy to these. And if you take the dual of this, you end up with the bounded operators And if you take the dual of this, again, something usually not discussed in the first course, you end up with something which is akin to the finitely additive measures of finite total variation, where these are measures on the lattice of subspaces. Now, the last two lines are interesting because they have four elements in them. And there's an interesting fact about Banach spaces, which is the following, that if you start off with a Banach space or a norm linear space, and you construct three duals worth, I can't imagine why anybody would want to do that. However, the following interesting fact occurs is that it is always true that this fellow is a natural embedding isometry of this into that, so you can consider E star as a subset of that. And this fellow is embedded in here, and we can calculate his annihilator. And that's a direct sum. So that the first dual is always continuously complemented in the third dual. In the case of B of H, or let's take this case, if I take these finitely additive measures of finite total variation on the integers, what this is telling me is that they are equal to the countably additive measures plus those measures that vanish on these sequences. But these sequences are the limits of the finite objects. And therefore, what we're showing is that every measure of this type can be written as a countably additive measure plus one which vanishes on all the finite subsets of the integers. These are called purely finitely additive measures. Likewise, in Hilbert space, this object is given by the trace class operators plus all the states which vanish on the finite dimensional subspaces, the purely finitely additive states. Okay, those are facts about Banach spaces. And you might say, well, what has that got to do with the previous example? Remember what I said, in most Banach space theory, you begin here and you work upward. It turned out, and when I was thinking about these things, and I was thinking about the things that Ludwig and Gunson had done, it dawned on me that as you will see in a moment, I got the following idea, that if I start here in this really ugly situation, could I possibly work myself backward to the things which built it? You say, well, why would you ever want to do that? Well, it turns out that this has some very simple and pleasant properties that these other fellows do not. And that's what I want to tell you. There's a few more facts about Banach spaces, but I'll put them in as we go. Okay, so what is written above, let me catch up to where I am. So we have this orthomodular poset, which is the logic. And I'm going to talk about delta as a convex set of all finitely orthogonally additive measures on the logic. Now the logic may be sigma complete, it may be complete, orthocomplete, it may have all kinds of extra properties, but I'm only interested in those states which are finitely orthogonally additive. In general, there'll be a lot of those, and in the situations I want to analyze, I always want to assume that there are a lot of these guys, otherwise we can't do any linear analysis at all. And a lot of, that's a technical term, it means as many as you'd like. Determines the orders, does everything you want it to do, and a little bit more if you're worried. So, and what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take those, the delta lives, you see, on the functions on pi. So I'm going to think of V delta as the subspace spanned by delta. So you take the span of delta in that function space. V delta is written as a difference of the positive cone. Those are just the multiples. We have a generating cone. And I want to look at the set U delta, which is nothing but the convex hull of delta union minus delta. So base, in the convex hull. The first observation is that U delta is, in the weak topology induced by these coordinates, if you will, is compact. Why? Because these are finitely additive. In limits, pointwise limits of finitely additive things are easily shown to be finitely additive. So compactness is something we obtain almost for free. How do I make this space of measures into a Banach space? I simply take the Minkowski functional of this convex compact set, the usual norm. This looks like the picture that you get when you deal with two-dimensional space that was illustrated in the last talk. If this represents delta, then minus delta is represented by that. In the convex hull is this. That's U delta. And if you want to form the dual of this in two dimensions, which I will in just a moment, it turns out to be there's a functional which makes one along here. So it lives here. And that's what the unit ball in the dual looks like. This is exactly L1, L infinity in two dimensions. Now, So I observe that that's weakly compact. And again, I've lifted this thing up according to the formula I've explained a moment ago. And I can think now of the points P acting on V, because the points act on the functions, and functions act on the points. And I can organize that into a partially ordered space. And so in this case, if this were the case, this would be P, this would be P prime, and this would be 0. And we would organize that into a linear space. And notice that this is what is called a base normed space. And this is called an order unit space. Now, what has this got to do with this business? Well, there is a theorem. There are two theorems in functional analysis, one of which is commonly known. It is called the Banach-Aliaglu theorem. And what it says is the following. He says, if you've got a Banach space and you construct its dual space, then the unit ball in the dual space is always compact in the weak star topology. Now, the weak star topology is nothing but the pointwise topology, and the Banach-Aliaglu theorem is nothing but an example of the Tychonoff product theorem from general topology. It took people a long time to realize that. But nonetheless, that's really what it says. And that's so dual spaces have weakly or weak star compact unit balls. Well, you can ask the converse question. Suppose I have a Banach space, and I ask the question, is it a dual space? Or is it isomorphic to a dual space? And the answer is summed up in the theorem by Dismier, Goldberg, Rustin, and one of the nice presentations of this material is in this book in Functional Analysis by Holmes, which is published by Springer. It's not a particularly easy book to read, but it has just got a wealth of information on the geometry of Banach spaces and functional analysis in general. And the theorem of Dismier et al. Is the following. It says, if I have a Banach space, and I'm asking, is this a dual space? It says the following. It says, look in its dual. If you can find a subspace in the dual, which is weak star dense, and the weak topology on that unit ball is compact, then that's a dual space. Now, look at this situation. If I look at V delta, and I take the set of propositions as a span, I observe that the unit ball in that space is propositionally compact in the space V delta. It is propositionally compact. It turns out that that space of propositions generates, in a weak sense, the space of all linear functionals on this space, V delta. Therefore, it must be that V delta is a dual space of the space of propositions. So, this is what's playing the role. This is what's playing the role of V delta. This is playing the role of the span of pi. And these two are in duality. This is an order unit space, which I can complete, and that's its dual. Now, I'm going to ask a few general questions, and I'm going to give you some answers that will eventually lead to the physical theory that I want to say. And that's the following. Is this a dual space? Well, in the case of Hilbert space, this is B of H. Is this a dual space? And in many cases, the answer is yes. In Hilbert space, this turns out to be the trace class operators. Now, one of my former students and I simplified a proof of a theorem, which I wasn't aware of for quite a while until we looked hard enough and we found this. But it says the following. It says that if you have an order unit space, if you have an order unit space, and it has a pre-dual, then it must be that the pre-dual is a base norm space. Now, it's not true that the pre-dual of a base norm space is an order unit space. However, if you have an order unit space and you try to construct the pre-dual of this, you will discover that it has to be a base norm space. So, in this case, if we can do this, we have V delta, we have the span, then we have V of, which I will call V of omega. And omega is a weakly dense convex set in delta. Now, in some of the papers, for example, that Gunson wrote back in the early 60s, late middle 60s, and in some of the earlier work of Ludwig, they would say things like this. They would say, well, I've got these states, and I know that I can take limits of states. So why don't we just make this omega that we want to deal with, the countably additive states, why don't we just make it into a compact set? Well, it turns out that if you do that mathematically, the theory is completely inconsistent. It just doesn't work. So it's the wrong thing to do. So this is a very delicate thing that you can construct this pre-dual and that this omega is not compact. In fact, it is weakly dense in this delta. Now, since time gets short, yes, I've already said what's on this page. I said the middle thing, that the dual of L, which I call this span, is actually V delta. Does LE have a pre-dual? Well, not always. There are examples where you can't do it. For example, if you take the reduced Borel algebra, you can find that there are no countably additive measures on that algebra. And you can show that when this thing has a pre-dual, the elements that are in omega have to be countably additive or completely additive measures. So there are places where this theory stops. However, what we would really like to get at, we'd like to say that this pi is an atomic orthomodular lattice. We'd like to be able to produce some of those classical results. What kind of conditions in this framework could produce the fact that this is an atomic orthomodular lattice? And that's what I'm going to show you. The first question is that when you can construct this V omega, when you can construct this V omega, you can observe that these things that are in here are completely additive measures. Because when you look at sequences of propositions which converge upward, that's nothing but weak star convergence, and these are weak star continuous linear functionals. So these turn out to be completely additive measures. First question is, are all the completely additive measures in omega at this point? And the answer seems to be no. I was given a counterexample to this after a somewhat spurious publication. However, the counterexample was a bit hokey too, because the logics itself didn't have too many infinite sets of orthogonal propositions. So it was kind of a cheap counterexample. In general, that is the content of Sakai's theorem on the pre-dual of a von Neumann algebra. You have a von Neumann algebra, and you ask, what is a von Neumann algebra? Is a C-star algebra that has a Banach pre-dual. And the question is, what is that Banach pre-dual? It turns out to be all the normal states that live on the algebra. Those are the completely additive states. And so the question I'm asking here is essentially Sakai's theorem in this context. What kind of conditions do we need in order to have a unique pre-dual which constitutes all of the completely additive measures? I don't know the answer to that question. It's either very hard or trivial, and I haven't figured out which one of the two it is yet. But it's at least confusing. Okay, let me go one step further, and then I'll release you from this burden. I want to ask one more duality type question. What does it mean for this space to have a pre-dual? Remember, I'm sort of trying to look at this model and this model. And it turns out that if this has a pre-dual, I don't know what the structure of the pre-dual is. I don't know if it's partially ordered. I don't have any idea what it looks like. However, let me tell you what comes from this. And this is sort of interesting. When this has a pre-dual space, then it turns out that the unit ball in this space, which is convex omega union minus omega, not only does it have extreme points, but it has what are called exposed points. Exposed points are points on the unit sphere which are cut off by a linear functional. Not all extreme points have that property, for example. Those are extreme points in that convex compact set. But there is no linear functional that cuts them off and touches only at the single point. So they are a refinement of the notion of extreme points. And there are this kind, where you get too many tangents. And then there are exposed points that are smooth points. And then there are smooth points that are not exposed. And the geometry of the norms and their derivatives, if you will, their Gettow derivatives, a very interesting subject in Banach spaces. And it turns out that you can show that when this is a dual space, that the unit ball is the closed convex hull, not only of the extreme points, but of the exposed points. Exposed points exist, and they are dense in the extreme points. This is the theorem. I'm not sure who put it all together, but one of the major contributors was Maser, who was a student of Banach. These exposed points are what determine the atoms in the quantum logic. And that's the reason for all of this. Let me state one last axiom, which Ludwig put in his book. And this, I think, is the essential thing which takes this abstract business and is what produces the Hilbert space. And that's the following. It says, if I look at the interval from 0 to E, the unit interval in the span, all the effects, if it has the following special property, it says, for all G1, G2, belonging to the interval. There exists a G belonging to the interval, which has the following property. G is less than or equal to G1 and G2, smaller. Of course, it's greater than or equal to 0. Doesn't have to be the mean. It's a smaller one. And it has the property. Let me write it this way. The set of all states, which give you the value 1, intersect the set of all states, which give you the value 1 on G2, is the same as the set of things which give you the value 1 on G. So you can find a G, always can, given any two effects, you can always find a G which is underneath, such that its set of measures with certainty is the intersection of the sets of measures with certainty of these two effects. You might say, strange axiom. Yeah, its consequences seem to be really surprising and good, and Ludwig makes a very strong use of this axiom, and he does it, and what happens as a result of this axiom, from this axiom he can show that the lattice of the orthomodular poset is an orthomodular lattice, that there is an interesting Galois connection. This axiom produces the effect that he can now define what are called decision effects. These are the smallest elements in order intervals. These turn out to be exactly the projections in the Hilbert space. And it suggests that the exposed points of this omega are in one-to-one correspondence with the atomic propositions. And the only problem that's missing is that you don't know that there are any atomic propositions. And a way to get the atomic propositions is to know that this space, V omega, is a dual space. So by looking at these pre-duals as you work your way back, I can get the existence of many of the physical axioms that both Gunson and Ludwig put into the theory from these mathematical hypotheses. I'm not saying that these mathematical hypotheses are better than the physical assumptions. I'm just saying that there's another way to look at these mathematical models which will produce this mathematics in a different way from mathematically acceptable situations. Why are they mathematically acceptable? Well, because we see them in the models we created out of mathematics. Now, I know that's a bit circular, but as you can see, Howard said that he was acquainted with topology but would never talk about it in public. I not only am acquainted with topology, I am intimately acquainted and more than happy, shamelessly, to display it in public. I am also, I believe that probability and statistics is everywhere, and whether we like it or not, it's the way the world is going to be in the future. So I think I've said all I wanted to say about that. It gives you a vague idea of what I was trying to say. Howard, I want to thank you and Matthew for the invitation. Joanna's and her husband have enjoyed this meeting very much. Let me close with a little poem about my views about mathematics and statistics and so on. It's only a little 4 lines. It does have 7 syllables in each line, so there is a bit of poetry to it. It's due to the Albert the Bard. All the world is a sample space, and we but merely puppets. While God plays dice with the universe, my knowledge is but poor verse. Oh, in finite dimensions, if you have all the things that I put up, it turns out you've got a Boolean algebra. That's the only example in finite dimensions. Yeah. Yeah, all of these last two examples, they all satisfy this. Oh, I see. No, I don't know operationally at all. No. I was interested in this simply because I always wondered if there was a way to get these atomic propositions out of, because you see, there are minimal elements in the lattice. And I thought, gee, that smacks of compactness. That's limits of nets or filters or something, you know. There ought to be some way to do this. And basically, the only topologies that are in dual spaces are the weak topologies. But the only way weak topologies can give you compact sets is dual spaces. So it sort of came around to me that the best way to look at these things was as dual spaces. And of course, I looked at all of the examples. And I never knew quite what to do with the fact that the finitely additive measures automatically gave me compactness. I really wasn't interested in those fellows. They were just too many of those. I've only found out later that people were interested in that. But I realized that once I did that, I was really trying to prove this thing about unique pre-duals. And for the longest time, I started off with countably additive measures and produced the propositions as linear functionals. It was a complete way to reverse this thing, to start with the propositions and produce the measures as the linear functionals, which is what I should have done as an analyst anyway. But Ludwig, as you know, is not easy to read. I mean, it's very heavy. And Gunson has a number of, I won't say they're erroneous statements, but they're certainly questionable. I mean, he makes an axiom in his paper. He simply says, in these propositional systems, we will assume that every proposition or its complement is finite. Well, I mean, that's essentially telling me that I'm living down in this first space, because these, it turns out, are the finite dimensional guys. And it's from these. And then I realized there was a theorem in L1 spaces by Pilchinski in about 1960 that said the following, that if you had an L1 space, and it turned out that the L1 space was a dual space, then it turns out that the measure space must be atomic. And I thought, gee, you know, how could that be? And then what I finally realized was that together with the Ludwig axiom, which does work in Banach lattices, it also works in operator algebras, that the Pilchinski theorem is the corollary of this whole business. There's also a good deal more here, that if you start looking at, for example, E double star here, modulo E, in the case of the finite dimensional logics, the countably additive measures, the order unit space. If you look at the order unit space modulo the first space, in the case of Hilbert space, that's the Kalkin algebra. In the case, you're looking at L infinity mod C naught, which is a kind of simplified example of the Calkin algebra. There are all kinds of interesting problems here that have been hard problems in analysis, and they are just simple, special ways of looking at this business. And so with all those observations, that's really my ultimate goal as I went along is, I believe, together with this axiom and pulling it down to the first space, I believe that this is Hilbert space in disguise, that there's a representation theorem in here, and that these atoms and these point, these extremal states are going to give you a GNS representation. That's only something I've come to in the last few weeks. This is an ongoing project. Gunson talks about spectral theory being produced from this, and I'm still battling, trying to get through that. But I think there's much more here than this. Really is pretty close either to Hilbert space or at least to a Jordan algebra, because we've only got real scalars. But there's a lot more here than has been revealed. Thank you. By the way, there's a huge stack of papers here.